Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host, and we're going to step into nature. That's exciting. It's a book called Step Into Nature. And for me, it was truly a step into fresh air, a breath of fresh air. It was so exciting, very enjoyable to read about nature from an author who really embraces it and walks her talk. So I'm so glad to have the author of Step Into Nature as a guest on Energy Stew, Patrice Vecchione. Patrice, welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you could. This was a joy to read because you actually not only have stepped into nature, you embraced it and are able to artistically bring your readers into nature with you. It was an experience that I had of the expression of the creativity, the imagination, the wonder of nature that you held as you explored it yourself and wrote about.
Thank you.
And so this is a book about when you're in nature. It's a kind of a guidebook on like what to bring, what to leave, how to get lost, and when to get found.
Yeah, you got to get lost first a few times before you get found. That was my experience anyway.
Right, and also you have a part of the book about being lost and how some people are better at being lost than others.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you fit in?
Well, when I started walking in the woods, I was afraid of being lost. But when I engage in creative process, in writing or making art, I've always known that I need to feel lost at the beginning. And that discomfort of feeling lost is the first step to going into new territory creatively. That helped me, that awareness helped me when I was walking in the woods to not feel as worried about getting lost. So I must say, I did everything I could to not get lost, like to pay attention to where I was, to notice, you know, any landmarks that were man-made, because those are easier to find again than the nature-made ones. But I did get lost, and now I don't mind it anymore. I kind of like it.
There's a quote in your book that if you stand still, the forest will find you.
Exactly.
So, and there's another part in your book. It brought me into a place that I appreciated, and it was when you were at Echo Lake, and you say that it is so quiet, my mother could be alive. Very poignant. And yet, to me, what it meant was that it was so quiet that people on the other side can talk to us because we're in that space.
You know, I still don't understand that line, actually, intellectually, but it resonates emotionally with me, and it's from a poem I wrote, and it resonates with readers as well, so I know there's something true in that line.
Yeah, to me, because I'm intuitive, and I do connect with the other side, and so I believe the other side is there, and that your mother is alive, and it's when we're in that quiet space that we can hear in other dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
So that part of your experience and that quote is, to me, very, very important.
I think when we're in nature, it's easier to get to the space where the veil between the two worlds becomes thin enough to hear through or to see through. When we're away from distractions that the cities often have for us. For me, anyway, I'm less distractible when I'm out in the woods or at the beach or in the desert.
Well, one thing that we're learning more and more is how amazing animals are in their awareness, in their extra senses.
Mm-hmm.
And they have so many abilities that humans might have, but because we are so distracted, we don't use.
Exactly.
And animals living in nature all the time tune in so much into their awarenesses and their abilities that we could probably find in ourselves if we needed to, because a lot of it is also survival on their part.
Right. Like, you know, cats, when they sleep, unlike us, they still hear everything that's going on. So they're easily alert and alertable, and that's a survival technique. A lot of it's about survival. And I think if we are to survive creatively, we need to develop some of the qualities that are evident in animals and other parts of the natural world.
And I think that's happening more and more. I do too. There are so many scientists who are working with animals, studying them and learning from them. So we're getting to a place where we're figuring out what they're good at and what we're good at and try to cross over in some ways that we can.
Yeah, learn from each other.
Yeah. There's so much of your book is experience, what you've learned from being in nature, how it has enhanced your life and your imagination and, you know, what it's done for you. And so reading the book for me was like being in nature, really, because I was experiencing it through you.
That's really cool.
Yeah. And so it excited my senses and opportunities that I hadn't realized before, because that's what you're bringing forth in this book, is how to really experience living in life through your experience in nature.
Yep.
And so there's a lot in it about how mysterious nature is and mm-hmm. how that helps us. How has it helped you?
I wasn't what one would call a nature girl when I started to walk in the woods. I went out to the woods because I had been a distance bicyclist and I have arthritis in my neck, so I couldn't ride the long distances anymore. And I didn't want to go to a gym for exercise, so I thought, well, I'll go walk and quickly in the woods. And that was the beginning of a transformation for me. I became more attentive, not only to the natural world, but to the whole world, to my own life. I noticed nuance more. I'm sitting in my office, in my house, looking out the window, and there are echium in bloom, which is a California plant with cone-like purple flowers. And I could see at least four different colors, four different shades of purple. Before I began walking in the woods, I think I would have looked out the window and said, oh, yeah, those flowers are pretty. But I wouldn't have really noticed how many shades of purple there are. So nature tuned, I say this in the book, it tunes our senses. It helps us to become more alert. It deepened my compassion. One day I saw a rat out in the park, and I really don't like rats. They freak me out. But this rat was sitting in the sun on a hot day, and normally a rat is nocturnal, and I realized it was hurt, so I got down on the ground, and I found myself talking to this injured rat, and the next thing I knew, I was crying, and I thought, what is wrong with you, Patrice? How can you feel compassion for a rat? And I realized any being suffering is the same as any other being suffering. So those are a couple examples of ways in which nature changed me.
Yes, and then we can feel that way about plants, too.
Yes, that's right. So I don't know about you, but I have to kind of watch my empathy because I can become a little bit too empathetic. And I know I cannot survive as a breatharian, so...
Uh-huh. We do have to honor the purpose of our lives and the purpose of plants and animals in giving to each other and sharing.
Exactly.
And so that's why animals can kill each other, and they have their own mentality about it. They are seeking food, and they might become food. And, of course, they're doing their best to stay alive, but, you know, they know the story, and they're living it.
Yep.
And we're doing our best to avoid it to the point where... You know, we force life among many people who really should move on. All they're doing is suffering for so many years.
Yes, we become overly attached to the idea of being alive, I think, sometimes.
Right, I've always said at some point in my life I should become food.
Right. Well, that's what I'd like to have happen to me when I die. I'd like to be just put out on a field somewhere and let the crows enjoy me.
Right. That's really sharing.
Right.
That's great. And so, you know, we have these opportunities to learn from just watching, and we can't watch from a distance. You had to really climb into it and learn
from
it.
Well, it's an illusion that we can know intimately from a distance. The only way we can know intimately is to be intimate and to get lost and to slip down a hillside and get dirty. And one day I got poison oak really bad, and I was really unhappy about it, but I sure learned about poison oak that way.
Right. So there are these experiences that we need to have, and it's kind of a survival awareness that we create when we're in the woods. but it brings the woods alive.
There's a mystical quality about the woods that also, I don't think, can be overlooked. There's a mystical quality in all of nature. I think there's an alignment in the natural world with that which is beyond this physical world. I find it most deeply when I'm alone in the forest.
Right. I think that's what animals connect with more than we realize. Is,
I bet you're right. Yeah. I bet that's really true.
Right. The people who are living their lives with nature and in nature are really enjoying more than we understand, unless we're doing it. I live in the city in an apartment. Luckily, I can look out on a park and I'm watching it, but it's very different from living in it. Fortunately, your book allows those of us who aren't in it to experience the journey that you've been on and learning and how you've learned from it. So we're learning from you. Now, let's go back to the fear part and how that feeds into art. That's a step, but you really had to be bold to start wandering into the unknown, into, you know, the mysteries of nature as well as...
Well, for me, it was a matter of boldness. And I think for a lot of people who aren't raised with an intimate relationship with the earth, it requires boldness. The first day I went to walk alone in the park, which is now it's a 900-acre park, about 10-minute drive from my home called Jack's Peak. The first day I went out there, a man came up to my car and he looked like a lunatic. And he was jumping around and he said, "You'll never believe it, I just saw a mountain lion." And he was happy about it. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to go home. I can't deal with this. This is too scary. And I said to myself, if I go home right now, I will never walk in nature alone. And I'm not willing to cut myself off like that. So I asked him, well, where were you? Which direction? He pointed. And I just went for a walk in the opposite direction. You know, mountain lions aren't out there to hurt us. They very, very rarely in modern history has a mountain lion attacked a person. And I'm no longer worried about it. But that first day, I had my twin fears meet me, a fear of crazy men and a fear of mountain lions. And, you know, so I was afraid for every day I walked, 5 days a week or so. For the first 6 months, every time I walked, I was afraid. And I just took the fear along as if it were an unwelcome companion. Until one day, all of a sudden, I realized that the fear was gone. And I hadn't asked it to go away, even though I wanted it to go. It just eventually, 6 months, nothing bad happened to me. You know, I got lost. That was the worst of it. There were no crazy men. No mountain lions tried to attack me. And I now go out in the park, and I hope I'm going to see a mountain lion. I never have. I probably never will. But I definitely go out hoping I might have the chance to see one, at a distance, mind you.
Right, but you have more of a sense of the rhythms of nature and understand that it's over this period of time, it's all still there. So likely you're going to still be there.
Exactly, exactly. And nature's, it's not out to harm us. You know, when we get insulated from it, as many of us are, then we can imagine that there's something there to harm us. Nature's just being nature. It's just doing its thing, just like we are. And it used to be everybody was close to nature because that's where life existed. There were no big cities. There were no large towns, small villages and people who lived, you know, in thatched huts in the woods. And those people, I imagine, had fear of nature, too, at times, when there were wolves and there were reasons to be afraid, and the weather, less insulation from the weather in the old times. But they weren't afraid of just taking a walk down to the stream to get some water, for the most part, because they lived there. They probably would have been scared to be, you know, in an apartment on the 20th floor.
Well, it's not that they didn't have any fears. It's just that they knew how to handle those fears better. They had defense mechanisms and awarenesses.
And they were familiar. I mean,
yeah.
I think that's a lot of why we get scared in the natural world is because we have a lack of familiarity with it.
Right.
And for the most part, humans tend to be afraid of things they're unfamiliar with.
Right, for sure. I'm glad that you're helping us become more familiar with the process of experiencing nature and learn to get what out of it. And for instance, you talk about smells, and you've learned to smell differently. Just like you said that with the flower, you learn to differentiate the colors more. There's so many more senses that you develop by your experience in nature that you weren't that used to.
So the more aware we are to detail and nuance and levels of awareness and specificity and a range of emotions and all of the senses, the more we're alive, the more life we have. And I want to be, while I'm here on this plane, I want to be as alive as I possibly can be. And being in nature, it has given me a range to my life that did not exist before.
Right, that's very clear. There's a term that you bring up in the book that I was unfamiliar with called synesthesia.
Right. The author Nabokov is probably the most famous synesthete. So those people who are synesthetes experience a number, they associate it with a color. So brown, the number 5 might be the color brown, or the number 7 might be the color green. And other people hear sounds connected to letters. So it's an overlapping and a crossing of senses. A woman I interviewed for the book had a temporary bout of synesthesia, and for her it was a horrible experience because when she heard the garbage trucks come by in the morning, she could taste the garbage. But for the most part, I don't think it's such a negative thing. It tends to be a positive thing. And there are a lot of people who are synesthetes, and they don't even realize that they are. Another artist, a visual artist, Kandinsky, was a synesthete. And I just heard a story about a woman who is a synesthete and hadn't known that Kandinsky was. And when she sat in front of one of his paintings, she began to weep because she could hear the painting. And then later she found out that also Kandinsky had that ability to overlap and cross senses.
Yeah, and maybe we can go into a museum and see a lot of paintings that the artist painted using other senses at the same time, and all we're seeing is what's on the canvas.
Exactly. I think that's probably true, and it's probably true with, you know, various art forms.
Yeah. Art and nature have so much in common in discovery, in magic, in form, and we're
and
trying to...
A lack of the rational mind being at the fore.
Right. So using art is one way, in a sense, of experiencing nature, trying to replicate it perhaps in our art forms, but only because it's an experience we're trying to communicate.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
There's so much about art that you've used from your experience in nature, and you've been teaching art, right?
As well as being a writer, I'm a visual artist. I make collage predominantly, some 3D, some with fabric, and some with pasted papers. And after walking in the woods, I took a little empty glass-fronted box and I stuffed it with dried pine needles. And in another, I made an arrangement of dahlia petals. It would have never occurred to me to take these very basic parts of nature, pine needles, flower petals, lichen, leaves, branches, and frame them so that I could look at them in an artistic way. But all of a sudden, that's what my imagination was asking me to do as a result of nature inspiring me.
Yes, and I've known artists, and there are famous artists from the past who have also brought natural objects into their art.
Mm-hmm. And then there's like Andy Goldsworthy and others who make art in nature, with nature, which is a whole other...
Oh, right. Yeah, there was a guy along the Hudson River who was using branches that had floated down the river, and he was pulling out all this refuse from the river and constructing art that he stuck into the rocks along the river. And at first, people thought it was fascinating, but then he didn't stop for a long time, and I just got really annoyed that he was...
Oh, it went on too far, huh?
Yeah, and he was interfering with the site. You know, it's like that guy who built those big fabric gates.
Throughout. Oh, Christos.
Yeah, and it was wonderful for 2 weeks, and then it was, okay, get him out of here, please. You know, all of a sudden, because you realize how, you know, we're intrusive that way.
Mm-hmm. And that's our human nature also, isn't it, to be intrusive. I'm trying not to be intrusive when I go into the woods.
But then you take what you get and bring it back with you, and you teach others to be artistic in the way that nature is artistic.
And nature is so artistic. I wondered, could I write a poem that would make the staccato of raindrops? You know, I'm wondering, looking out my window, could I make a collage that had every one of these hues of purple and blue in it? Nature is never boring. It's never repetitive. It's never the same. It's always new, and it's the most creative thing that exists.
Right.
In the whole world is the natural world. The earth is infinitely creative. When I was working on the book, I write about that in the book, and someone read that, and he got very angry at me. He said, "You're talking about nature as if it were a person. You can't say nature is creative. Nature is just nature." But I disagree, because if you look at how, if water comes upon an obstacle, if there's a rock in the way of flowing water, the water will find a way. It will either make a little tunnel underneath, it will go over, it will go around. Well, those are creative solutions. They're inventive solutions to deal with a problem. And humans, and we are, there's a lot of work being done watching how nature behaves. There was the man who invented Velcro. He created Velcro because of the burrs that were in his dog's fur.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
And then the creativity of so many different kinds of flowers and colors and forms of birds. It goes on and on how magically artistic nature is.
It is. And, you know, the writer David Rothenberg has done some fascinating work in looking at the creativity of bower birds. These are Australian birds. The male birds will make elaborate nests, and they'll make them from man-made things as well as nature things, and they have a proclivity for the color blue, because the color blue attracts the female. And the bower bird who makes the most elaborate nest gets the girl. You know, so
right.
Then it brings into question, well, is there not a deliberateness on the part of animals to be creative?
I've seen pictures of those birds sitting on their elaborate nests waiting to be discovered.
Yeah, and you can look them up. One can find those pictures of those nests and the birds on the internet, and it's fascinating. They're large birds. And even I think about, there was a feral cat in my neighborhood, and she started coming around to my house at dinner time, and so my husband and I began to feed her, and we noticed she kept getting fatter and fatter, and it was more fat than we were feeding her. Well, she had kittens. Where did she have her kittens? In underneath a little cottage in my backyard. And while my husband and I were on vacation a couple of weeks later, she brought her three little babies into my office and made a nest behind a bookcase. That's resourceful, and resourcefulness is a form of creativity. What do you do when you're under duress? You come up with a solution you would not have come up with otherwise.
In my apartment, I'm on the ground floor right off of Riverside Park, and many years ago, almost 40 years ago now, a window was open one day, and a cat came in and had babies in one of the closets in the apartment.
Wow! And what did you do with them?
I don't remember. I think we found people who could take care of the whole thing. We weren't...
Right.
Yeah. But it was fascinating to see how, you know, nature finds its way, and our apartments are an opportunity sometimes.
Right, in ways we don't plan.
Right. You live in Monterey, which is a fascinating place to love nature.
It's an incredible place to love nature, because there's the ocean, there's Big Sur, there's Point Lobos, gorgeous places. Where I hike, Jack's Peak Park, is about 3 miles away from the beach, and it's rather hilly terrain and very wooded. So there's so many places here. You go outside and there's nature.
And in New York, certainly where I am, I'm looking out right now, I can see the Hudson River through the trees in Riverside Park. We also have Central Park. Now, you have Jack's Peak Park, which is 900 acres. Central Park is 800 acres. It's pretty large. It's mostly a manicured park. there is some wilderness in the north side.
You know, you don't have to live in some place in a small city in order to be in nature. Just like you're saying, there's two parks, and there's Fort Tryon Park, which is near where I grew up in New York, and there's lots of little neighborhood corner parks. And just to stand at the Hudson River, there's nature. If you can't get outside, if you just open the window and lean your head out and look up, well, what is that? The sky. It's nature. So it's everywhere. All our cities, all our buildings are on the earth.
And the city is trying to plant trees all over the place now. I think they want to plant 1 million trees around the city.
Wow, what a great project. That's a lot of trees.
Yeah, I think it's been funded privately, and so it's really a nice thing that so many sidewalks, which were barren now, are trees growing. So
that's terrific, as it should be. We need the trees to breathe.
Right.
We need the bees to eat. We need the trees to breathe.
This is exciting to talk about nature with you, because you're really from New York City.
Right.
And as you say, you're not a wilderness expert. You're not somebody who's here to talk about wilderness. You're really here to talk about how fascinating nature is for someone who had to learn about it.
Exactly. I was not inclined toward it at all. I have a younger sister, and when we were children, she brought in all the stray animals, and she, as a young woman, went backpacking for months at a time, and forget about it. I'd rather take a plane to New York City and go to the museums and put on a nice pair of high heels, not a pair of hiking boots, and I've completely changed. I'm much more the nature girl than the city girl now.
So wonderful. And I think your book, Step Into Nature, is going to create a lot more excitement among people to experience that, to learn from it, not just to think, oh, it'll be nice to go out into nature, but to understand from your experience what they can learn from it. And I think that's what's important about the book, is that it draws people to open up in life, and not only in nature, but even as artists, because you talk about how it can be transposed into the pioneering of being an artist, and pioneering of walking into a forest is the same kind of thing.
It's the same process. It's going into uncharted territory in the artistic process. And I encourage everybody, whether you see yourself as an artist or not, or as a writer or a musician or not, if you have a desire to make art, there is such enormous fulfillment in just in the experience of making art, separate from whatever happens to that art in the world. The personal experience of doing it is one of the most enriching things I've ever experienced.
And one way to transpose nature into art is from a phrase in your book that you use called catch as catch can. And that's how to fish in art. So how do we do that?
That's right. You just put your bait on the end of your line, and what's the bait? The bait is curiosity. The bait is wonder. The bait is desire. And you cast that line out into the sea of creativity, and you don't know what will come back. In fact, if you knew, if I sat down to write and I knew what I was going to write, why bother? There's no fun in that. There's no discovery in that.
Right.
I write because I want to discover what's there. I like to be surprised.
Right. So it's not only, the book's not only Step Into Nature, it's Nurturing Imagination and Spirit in Everyday Life.
That's the
subtitle. Right. So Patrice Vecchione, thank you so much for being a guest on Energy Stew. Where can people go on the web to find you?
I have a website, PatriceVecchione.com. That's PatriceVecchione.com.
Thank you so much, Patrice, for being a guest on Energy Stew. It's been wonderful talking with you.
Thank you so much, Peter.
And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org or 212-222-7748. I'd love to hear from you, and thank you so much for listening.